Oh, yeah, it's Bigler's World on Sun Sounds, Arizona. And I'm Jim Bigler for the next hour, and I got kids' magazines all over the place. What do I got here? I got stuff like Ranger Rick, Sports Illustrated for kids, maybe some science news, Explorers for kids. Let's start with a little news here. Dogo. It's Dogo news for kids. Astronomers capture first close-up picture of a star outside our galaxy, says Cavi Dolazio, who wrote this article. Over the years, astronomers have managed to capture a few images of stars and galaxies beyond Earth. However, these images have always appeared as mere points of light, even when seen through powerful telescopes. Well, now, thanks to a very large telescope, or a VLT, I'll take a VLT. Hold the mayo. Scientists have captured the first close-up image of a massive star located a staggering 160,000 light-years from Earth. The star, named cleverly WOHG64, lies in the Large Magellanic Cloud. The nearby dwarf galaxy is visible from the southern hemisphere. Certified as a red supergiant, WOHG64 is one of the largest stars in the universe. It is over 1,500 times larger and 282,000 times brighter than our sun. Astronomers have known about the aptly nicknamed Behemoth Star for decades. However, an actual image of the star had remained elusive until now. The photo, revealed on November 21st of 2024, shows a cocoon of gas and dust around WOHG64. Scientists believe this indicates that the star is shedding its outer layers. This process can last thousands of years. It signals that it may be entering its final stage of life before becoming a supernova. The cocoon's egg-like shape is either due to the star's rotation or the influence of an undiscovered companion star. Let's see, who is this? Dr. Kaichi Onaka. He's an astrophysicist at the Andres Bello National University in Chile. He says, "We discovered an egg-shaped cocoon closely surrounding the star. We are excited because this may be related to the drastic ejection of material from the dying star before a supernova explosion. As the star becomes dimmer, it may be difficult to get other close-up images, even for the VLT. However, researchers hope that future upgrades to VLT's instruments will address this issue. Located in Chile's Atacama Desert, the Very Large Telescope is one of the world's most advanced astronomical observatories. It consists of four, count them, four, 27-foot diameter telescopes that can be combined to form a single, extremely powerful telescope. They enable scientists to study the universe in unprecedented detail, from the formation of distant galaxies to the detection of exoplanets." Next article here on Bigler's World. Let's go up north here, north of the border. CBC Kids News. Test your Taylor Swift knowledge. Because we definitely haven't heard enough about Taylor Swift this week. The CBC Kids News Quiz will test your knowledge of the latest news stories and current events. What do you know about the biggest headlines? Have you been paying attention to the latest trends? It wants me to test my knowledge. Maybe I'll do it. I don't know. It says, look here, you probably already know all about Taylor Swift. The pop star's first Eras tour in Canada took place in a cloud of glitter. It was a big cloud in Toronto, November 14th. After six sold-out shows in the city, she headed to Vancouver, British Columbia for three more. But how much do you really know about Swift? Probably more than we do. Take this quiz and prove it. It's not tickets to the Eras tour, but it's something to do. So I'm going to take the tour right now and see what they says here. How many concerts is Taylor Swift playing in Canada as part of the Eras tours? I want to care about Canada. Actually, it's a Canada thing. I'm going to say nine. I'm going to submit that. It says correct. I have no idea how I knew that. I didn't know it. I just guessed. Which of these is not the name of one of Taylor Swift's cats? They've got Olivia Benson, Fraser Crane, I like that, Benjamin Button, and Meredith Grey. I'm going to go with Fraser because It says correct. Taylor Swift is famously a cat lover. Her three cats are all named after pop culture characters. Olivia Benson is from the show Law and Order, SVU. Meredith Grey is from Grey's Anatomy, and Benjamin Button is from the movie The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Swift herself appeared as a cat in the 2019 musical film Cats. I did not know that. I wouldn't have gotten that question. Speaking of which, the next one here. What was the original price range, for a floor seat ticket at one of Swift's Toronto shows? I'm going with $1,000. They got $10 to $50. $150 to $600, $1,000 to $2,500, or $3,000 to $500. I'm going to do this. It says incorrect. At live events, floor seats are usually the ones closest to the stage. If you were lucky enough to snag a seat when they first went up for sale on Ticketmaster, you would have had to fork over $150 to $600. But those are Canadian dollars. They're not worth as much as ours. So some people who bought tickets at the original price later sold them for even more money. Really? That happens? Because they were in such high demand. Next question. Earlier this year, three concerts on the European leg of the Eras Tour were canceled after authorities learned of a planned terrorist attack. What city were they supposed to be in? Was it Florence, Italy? Was it Berlin? Was it Glasgow? Or was it Vienna? Seems like it was in Germany. And it says incorrect. August 7th, Taylor Swift's three sold-out shows in Vienna, Austria. Well, that's the same thing as Germany, isn't it? They were canceled after authorities learned of a plan to stage an attack outside the stadium. What was Taylor Swift's first song to chart on the Billboard Hot 100? Teardrops on My Guitar. Then there was a song called Tim McGraw, apparently, Love Story, and We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. I like that one. But for some reason, I want to say Love Story. I guess it doesn't matter. I'm also incorrect on this. The Billboard Hot 100 chart ranks the most popular songs every week. Back in 2006, when Taylor Swift was she still in the womb? Taylor Swift's debut single, Tim McGraw, entered the chart at number 86. As of February 2024, her music has appeared on the chart 232 times. Her first song to reach the number one spot was 2012's We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. Ever. Ever. I threw those last two. Okay, you scored 2 out of 5 points. It wants me to retry? I don't think so. Okay, enough with the heavy stuff. Let's go over to Science News Explorers. Science. Microscopic black holes may be flying through our solar system. I don't like the sound of that. Massive, but atom-sized, these flybys could jostle the orbits of planets and satellites, says Emily Conover. Not this particular article. Microscopic black holes could be careening through our solar system unnoticed. But their days of stealth may be numbered. Two research teams have just proposed ways to spot such baby black holes, if they truly exist. These black holes would pack the mass of an asteroid into the space of about the size of a hydrogen atom. Scientists suspect that objects like this could have formed in the very early universe. For that reason, they are known as primordial black holes. Primordial means existing from the beginning. One way to find primordial black holes is to look for the effects of their gravity on planets. Another way is to look for their gravitational pull on satellites. Finding primordial black holes could solve a big mystery about the universe, namely, what is dark matter? That invisible stuff makes up 85% of the matter in our universe. Scientists know it exists because its gravity pulls on things that we can see, stars within galaxies, for instance, but no one knows what dark matter is made of. Researchers have searched high and low for particles that could explain dark matter, but those searches have all come up empty. If tiny black holes are caught wandering the cosmos, that could explain what makes up some or all dark matter. Small objects? Big gravity. Black holes typically form when a dying star collapses. This creates a black hole with at least several times the mass of the sun. Some scientists think smaller black holes might have formed in the early universe, Back then, bits of space might have collapsed on their own. That would have pinched off fairly small bits of matter into teeny, tiny black holes. Some of those primordial black holes may have asteroid-sized masses. If so, they might whiz through the inner solar system about once a decade, researchers estimate. That means there's no need to worry about a tiny black hole crashing into you. That's less likely than a peanut thrown at random hitting a specific blade of grass in a lawn the size of a trillion football fields. Okay, I'm trying to imagine that. I can't. When a tiny black hole passes near a planet, though, it could have noticeable effects. Who is this? Sarah Geller? Isn't she an actress? This cosmologist is at the base of the University of California, Santa Cruz. She says, the incredibly strong gravity of this primordial black hole will make Mars wobble in its orbit around the sun. Sarah Geller worked on the planetary wobble study. In the future, she and her colleagues plan to test this idea using detailed models of the solar system. A primordial black hole could also jostle satellites. Imagine a black hole with the mass of an asteroid coming within the moon's distance of the Earth. It could change the altitudes of satellites and detectable amounts. I'm not going to read that again. Who is this? Sebastian Cleese. Who is he? He's a cosmologist at the Université Libre de Bruxelles in Belgium. I was going to say Brussels. He says, that's very exciting to know. We have some probes that could be used to really detect baby black holes in the solar system. He worked on a satellite-based detection method, in case you are wondering. A satellite search would be useful for finding black holes of smaller masses than the planetary wobble technique, says Bruno Bertrand. He's an astrophysicist based at the Royal Observatory of Belgium in Uccle. He worked on the satellite research with Clissé, and he says this, this is very complimentary. That's all he has to say, apparently. When to blame black holes. Plain old asteroids could mimic the gravitational effects of the tiny black holes, but the black holes would have speeds of roughly 100 miles per second, and they would come soaring in from the outside of the solar system. That's rare for space rocks. It was this Ben Lemon. What is he? He's a physicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge. He helped devise the planetary wobble method. And he says this, we have never seen an object pass through the solar system that would have the characteristics of a black hole. But if scientists do spot a planet wobbling on its orbit, they would still want to check for any space rocks that it might contain. Other celestial effects could also tweak planetary orbits. These would need to be ruled out before blaming a tiny black hole, says Andreas Burkett. He's an astrophysicist who did not take part in either study, but for some reason he works at the Ludwig Maximilian University Munich in Germany. I'm not sure why they mentioned him. A solar wind of charged particles streaming out from the sun can affect the orbits of planets, Burkert notes. And confirming that changes into satellite motions that are due to black holes that can be quite challenging. A tiny black hole passing close enough to Earth to be detected this way could be extremely rare, he says. Right now, he adds, I don't think it's realistic, but he remains optimistic that it might be possible at some point. And the next article here on Bigler's World, sticking with science news explorers. Let's do the thing on rocket propellants. Since we're talking about space, together, fuel and oxidizers make up rocket propellants that help spacecraft get to where they need to go. Maria Temming wrote this here. Rocket propellants. Rockets need two things to propel them forward. One is fuel. The other is a source of oxygen or an oxidizer to help burn that fuel. Together, fuels and oxidizers are known as rocket propellants. Two common fuels for blasting off into space are liquid hydrogen and liquid methane. Both of these chemicals are gases at room temperatures, but when cooled to extremely low temperatures, they become liquids that can be stored in tanks. Such super cooled fuels are cryogenic. They can be burned with a cryogenic oxidizer, liquid oxygen. Once a spacecraft is up in space, cryogenic propellants may not cut it. Those liquids may boil off. Who is this talking here? Stephen Heister. He's an aerospace engineer at Purdue University. Those liquids may boil off if we're going to be on a long mission. Let's see here. In space, we could use what are called storable fuels, he says. Kerosene, is one example. It's similar to the gas we put in our cars. Another storable fuel is a toxic chemical called hydrazine. These fuels are liquid at room temperature. They don't need to be super cooled. That makes them easier to store. We have a whole array of different fuels that we use and an array of different oxidizers, Heister says. When it comes to storable oxidizer, hydrogen peroxide is one option. You might have seen this chemical at the store. The hydrogen peroxide in the grocery store is all of 3% hydrogen peroxide. The other 97% is water. The stuff we work with is kind of the opposite. It's 97% hydrogen peroxide and only 3% water. Another storable oxidizer is a substance called nitrogen tetroxide. And that's how they end the article. Okay, let's go to another publication entirely. Do a little news for kids. This entitled Mummy of a 35,000-year-old saber-toothed kitten is found in Siberia. In 2020, a group of explorers looking for mammoth tusks in eastern Siberia made a surprising discovery. The mummy of a 35,000-year-old saber-toothed kitten. Doesn't sound right for some reason. The find is first of its kind. It's giving scientists a new look at saber-toothed cats. The kitten mummy was found in the permafrost near the, if I can pronounce this, Badyarkara River. That's in Siberia. Permafrost is a layer of ground in Arctic and Antarctic areas that remains frozen. As the world has warmed due to climate change, areas of permafrost are thawing, revealing secrets long buried and frozen. Saber-toothed cats were large, meat-eating animals that lived thousands of years ago. They were known for their long, sharp teeth. Though they looked a bit like tigers or lions, saber-toothed cats died out around the end of the last ice age and aren't related to any kind of cats that exist today. I did not know that. Scientists have studied the bones of saber-toothed cats before, including a saber-toothed kitten's, but this is the first time a saber-toothed mummy has been found, giving scientists a chance to learn about its muscles, skin, and fur, and even things like the size of its ears. The kitten was very young, only about 3 weeks old when it died. By studying the mummy with CT scans, the researchers were able to identify it as a Homotherium saber-toothed cat. Homotherium was the last kind of saber-toothed cat known to have existed. Homotherium adults were about the size of a lion, but thinner and good at running long distances. Scientists already knew this. They also knew that these cats had a very thick neck. In this case, the kitten's neck was about twice as thick as a lion's cubs would be. But the well-preserved mummy also brought some surprises. One surprise was the color of the kitten's soft fur. It was a deep, dark brown. Many modern cats, like lions and pumas, are born with spots as babies. These spots often fade as the animals grow. But the saber-toothed kitten had no spots at all. The kitten had clumps of hair at the sides of its mouth. It's possible that adult saber-toothed cats may have had hair on their faces, perhaps similar to a beard. The kitten hadn't developed its long teeth yet, but it did have a long upper lip. That could suggest that the long teeth of the Homotherium adults were kept covered most of the time. The kitten's paws were round like those of a lynx, but the pads on the paws were square, unlike the pads on modern cats. The kitten also didn't have a pad on the back of its wrist, like cats and dogs do today. The scientists think the Homotherium's paws might have made it easier for it to walk on snow. The scientists have learned a lot, but there's still more to study. They plan to examine the kitten much more closely, including studying its DNA. The researchers are hopeful that more Homotherium mummies might be discovered one day, perhaps even an adult. Okay, let's do one more article here. From News for Kids, scientists discover the world's largest coral. I heard about this somewhere. What is this? I can pronounce this. Malawalo, wherever that is. It's in the Solomon Islands. Scientists on a National Geographic research trip to the Solomon Islands have discovered the world's largest coral, a single coral colony made up of around 1 billion tiny creatures, is so large it can be seen from space. Though underwater corals may look like rocks, they're actually made out of millions of tiny animals called polyps. Together, the polyps form a colony. A coral reef is normally built out of lots of colonies in different kinds. But in this case, scientists discovered a giant structure built entirely out of one species of coral known as Pavona clavus. All the polyps in this colony are the same kind, and the researchers believe that this colony contains about 1 billion coral polyps. The blue whale is usually considered the largest creature in the ocean, but the giant coral is even larger. It measures 111.5 feet wide by 105 feet long, and it's about 18 feet high. In all, the coral colony covers the same area as five tennis courts. The colony is believed to be between 300 and 500 years old. It's a massive rolling mound made up of thousands of smaller lumps. The coral is mostly brown, but it has yellow, blue, and red patches. The coral colony is home to many kinds of sea life, including sea shrimp, crabs, and different kinds of fish. The coral was discovered by Manu San Felix. He's a marine scientist at the underwater photographer. He's working for the National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project. When the researchers first spotted the coral from their boat, it was so large that they thought it was a shipwreck. That all changed when Mr. San Felix dove down for a closer look, and he said, "It's a dream to see something unique like this," he said in a strange accent. The newly discovered coral sits in water that's around 33 feet deep and seems to be doing well, even when many other corals aren't. In recent years, coral reefs around the world have been damaged by rising ocean temperatures caused by global heating. This is often called coral bleaching because huge areas of coral can turn white as they die. As of 2023, around 75% of the world's coral reefs have been affected by coral bleaching. Since the giant colony is doing so well, that may mean that it can survive in warmer temperatures. Clearly, it had to be tough to remain alive for hundreds of years, as one marine scientist who wasn't part of the discovery said,
"Anything old is really good at surviving."
That could be good news. It might mean that the colony will be able to produce new corals that can survive in warmer waters. The discovery of the coral colony is also important for the Solomon Islands. The, if I can pronounce this, Poanapania, whatever they are, they're a tribe, which is responsible for the waters around Malawalo, has been working to protect the area. Now, tribe members hope the discovery will encourage the country to protect this area even more. Okay, let's go to another publication here. Let's do a little Frontiers for Young Minds. This article entitled "Seeing Eye to Eye: How Culture Affects Our Understanding of Others' Minds." Freaky. Manali Pather and Michael C. Hout wrote this article. Understanding others' perspectives and feelings. Many of us have wondered not just what other people think, but how they think. In fact, there is a skill humans have that helps us understand other people's perspectives and feelings. This capacity is called theory of mind, and it is essential for us to be able to talk to each other and comprehend one another's behavior. The human ability to look beneath the surface enables us to understand that people have thoughts, dreams, and feelings that are not always obvious. Understanding TOM is important because it helps us build empathy and compassion towards others, and it also plays a critical role in our social interactions and relationships. By recognizing that others have unique thoughts and feelings, we can adjust our behaviors and communication to better connect with them. Therefore, improving our TOM skills can help us become better communicators, problem solvers, and empathetic individuals. I think I pronounced that wrong. I'm not sure. Interesting, the article continues. Interestingly, the way you understand what others are thinking and feeling can differ depending on where you grew up and what values you were taught. For example, some cultures put a lot of emphasis on working together and thinking about the needs of the group. This is called interdependence. While other cultures encourage people to be independent and make their own choices, this is called independence. In some places, families live together and share everything they have because they their particular value of taking care of each other, while in other places, people are encouraged to move out of their parents' homes and live on their own when they grow up. These unique cultural values can shape how people think about and understand others. Studies have found that people who grew up with values that emphasized working together and caring about others are exceptionally good at understanding what other people are thinking and feeling. These individuals are particularly skilled at seeing things from other people's points of view, which is called perspective taking. What are the processes involved in TOM? Well, you might wonder why TOM varies based on culture. This is because TOM develops differently for different people, and it relies on a series of cognitive processes that develop as children grow up. These differences in life experiences lead to differences in the ability to understand others' thoughts and emotions. These cognitive processes include diverse desires, understanding that different people can want different things. Then there's diverse beliefs, understanding that different people can believe different things. False beliefs, understanding that someone can believe something that is not true. Then there's knowledge access, understanding that someone can know something that you do not know. And finally, hidden emotions, understanding that someone can feel one thing but show a different emotion on the outside. Although children all around the world develop TOM in similar ways, the order in which they learn about these things, like diverse beliefs and desires, can be different depending on the culture they come from. For example, in some cultures, it is important to think about what other people want, even if it's not what you want. As a result, children in these cultures might learn about diverse desires before they learn about false beliefs. Also, in some cultures, children learn about knowledge access before they learn about false beliefs. This means that they learn about how people can know things, like by seeing or hearing something, before they learn that people can believe something that is not true. These differences have been observed across Asian and Western countries, but also within different parts of Western continents. For example, Italy and Britain are geographically near one another, but have different parental and social expectations that can affect how children develop their TOM skills. In Italy, children are more likely to be raised with interdependent values of cooperation and group harmony, such as being encouraged to express emotions openly within the family. By contrast, in Britain, children may be more likely to be raised with independent values of individualism and personal achievement, and therefore might be taught to keep their emotions to themselves, especially in public settings. These differences in values and expectations can influence how children learn to understand and interpret other people's thoughts and feelings, and thus their development of TOM. Furthermore, socialization is a key process for acquiring TOM. Kids who grow up with siblings and had more socialization tend to be better at TOM. In addition to the culture we grow up in, how much we socialize with others, especially siblings, plays a big role in how good we are at understanding other people's thoughts and feelings. Studies have shown that kids who have siblings and interact with them a lot tend to be better at TOM than kids who do not have siblings or do not interact with them as much. This is because having siblings provides more opportunity to practice socializing and understanding other people's perspectives. So how do researchers study TOM? Differences in TOM are not limited to childhood, as adults from diverse culture and developmental backgrounds also show varying performance levels on TOM tasks. For instance, researchers used a game called the Director Task to understand how people understand perspectives. In this game, two participants, they sit at a table with several objects in front of them. One person, called the director, tells the other person, called the participant or subject, where to move the objects. Importantly, in some situations, the director cannot see all of the objects because of where they are placed, and the participant is aware of this. The participant is asked to move a specific object, but there is often another object that might get in the way. For example, imagine you are a little girl in looking at a shelf. The director asks you to move the small ball to the left. You might wonder if the golf ball is the correct item because that is the small ball on the shelf that you can see. But then you remember that the director cannot see everything that you can see. In fact, because there is a backing on the shelf with the golf ball, the director cannot see that item. So he must be referring to another small ball, like the tennis ball on the top right. To do this task correctly, you must understand things not just from your perspective, but from the director's. The researchers wanted to see if their participants could understand the director's instructions, keeping in mind that what can be seen from the director's perspective is different from the participant's perspective, and not get confused by an incorrect object. Interestingly, the difference in perspective taking is also observed in people's eye movements when they are looking at things. Eye movements help us understand TOM. Eye tracking is a research method used to determine what a person is paying attention to and how that relates to the person's cognitive processes. Eye tracking involves measuring the movements of the individual's eyes as they look at images or text. This method provides researchers with a wealth of information about where individuals look, for how long, and in what sequence. By analyzing eye movements, researchers can better understand how individuals make decisions and engage with the environment around them. For instance, researchers have used eye tracking to investigate how children understand others' emotions. Researchers showed children pictures of people with different facial expressions and tracked their eye movements. They found that children who looked more at the eyes of the person in the picture were better at understanding that person's emotions than were participants who looked more at other facial features like the nose or mouth. Another research group used eye tracking to study how people understand others. They used two measures to assess eye behavior during the task: how long it took participants to look at the correct object, the tennis ball, and how often they looked at the incorrect object, the golf ball. The number of times the subject looked at the golf ball was used to determine whether the subject considered the incorrect object as a potential correct response. Similarly, the amount of time it took a participant to look at the tennis ball was used to evaluate the extent to which the presence of the incorrect object, the golf ball, interfered with the participant's ability to identify the correct one. By examining these eye tracking measures, the researchers could reveal any temporary confusion experienced by the participant, as shown by a delay in finding the correct object. The researchers also examined cases in which the confusion was not resolved by considering the tendency of participants to ask for clarification. For example, if a participant asked which shelf, it was probably because they thought the director could have had either shelf in mind. This indicated that the participant did not distinguish between the correct shelf, which was visible to the director, and the incorrect shelf, which was visible only to the participant. Eye tracking measures showed that Chinese participants, who tend to be more interdependent and community-oriented, focused more on the director's perspective in comparison to American participants, who tend to value independence and self-expression. American participants focused more on the incorrect object and delayed their selection of the correct one. In contrast, Chinese participants did not have as much difficulty finding the correct object and did not spend as much time looking at the incorrect object. This indicated that Americans tend to focus more on their own perspective, while Chinese participants tend to pay more attention to others' perspective. Overall, the results suggest that there are cultural differences in the ability to take another's perspective in the director task. Eye tracking measures helped reveal this cultural difference and provided insights into the underlying cognitive processes involved in perspective taking. So, why are TOM differences important? Well, studying cultural differences in TOM is important for understanding the complex relationships between culture, cognitive processes, and social behavior. Culture influences the way we think, communicate, and interact with others, and TOM is a crucial aspect of social interactions that help us understand and navigate social solutions. By examining how individuals from different cultural backgrounds perform on TOM tasks, we can better understand how culture shapes the development and the use of this important ability. This knowledge can be important for areas such as education, cross-cultural communication, and social policy. For instance, understanding cultural differences in TOM can help teachers design more effective learning strategies and lessons that account for cultural diversity, can aid communication and collaboration across cultures, and can help to develop policies that promote social inclusion and equality. Okay, let us go to another publication here. Entirely brand new publication. 8 Fantastic Facts About Pangolins is the name of this article from Ranger Rick. And let's see who wrote this. Ann Cecil says right here, these scaly creatures are full of surprises and in need of protection. Here's the article. What do you think this animal is? Is it a lizard? A pine cone with a head and legs? Not quite. It's a mammal, just as mice, monkeys, and you are. It's called a pangolin, and it is really a one-of-a-kind animal. Just look at those hard scales. They cover its body from the tip of its nose to the end of its tail. No other mammal has that kind of covering. There are 8, count them, 8 species of pangolin in the world, and all of them are in trouble. That's because pangolins are thought to be the most trafficked wild mammal in the world. That means people illegally capture and move them to other countries where they may be sold. Some people eat their meat. Others think their scales can cure diseases. Science has found no evidence that they can. People pay a lot of money for pangolin meat and scales, but other people are working hard to stop the traffickers and help these gentle creatures survive. What makes pangolins so special? It wants me to turn the page to find out. I'm going to have to turn the page here. I have to. They told me to. Number one, some can walk on 2 legs. Most species of pangolin use all 4 legs to walk, but a ground pangolin, like this one here, almost always strolls along on its hind legs, using its tail for balance. Some people think that it looks like a little T-Rex walking along. Using 2 legs makes it easier for this type of pangolin to point its snout in the air and catch a whiff of any ants or termites around, otherwise known as dinner. Number 2, they have scales and hair together. A pangolin's hard, overlapping scales are made of keratin, the stuff your fingernails and hair are made of. The scales protect the pangolin from attack because they are tough and sharp. As with all mammals, pangolins have hair. Those hairs are mostly on the parts that aren't covered by scales, including their bellies. But on Asian pangolins, some of those hairs also stick out between the scales. Number 3, they have long, strong claws. Pangolins use their sharp senses of smell and hearing to locate their favorite foods, termites and ants, but those insects live underground. No problem. Pangolins can turn into mini backhoes. Their strong front legs and sharp claws are perfect for digging out tasty treats. The claws also come in handy for tunneling out burrows to sleep in during the day. Some pangolins also use their claws to climb trees. Then there's number 4. They have very long tongues. Once they've dug up an ant or termite colony, it's time to eat. Penguins have very long, sticky tongues for slurping up prey. It commands me to check out the tongue on the ground penguin above. It's longer than its body, minus its tail. Yikes. A penguin's tongue isn't attached in its mouth the way our tongues are. It is attached to the bottom of its rib cage. Now, this is freaky. Another fun fact, very fun, penguins don't have teeth. Instead, they have rough stuff, such as small stones, in their stomachs to help grind up food. Number 5, they roll into balls. When threatened, penguins roll up tight, so only their hard scales are facing out. Most predators will move on to find easier prey. But if a penguin needs to fight, it can lash out with its sharp-edged tail. It can also release a smelly chemical into the air to ward off enemies. Does that remind you of a skunk? I guess if you got sprayed, it wouldn't remind you. Number 6, some climb trees. While many penguins stick to the ground, some are expert climbers or even sleep in hollows or forks of trees. Their sharp claws help them climb. Also, these climbers' tails are partially prehensiled, which means they can grasp things the way your hands do. This helps the penguins hold on to branches while they use their sharp claws to strip away bark to get at tasty insects underneath. And number 7, the babies ride on their mother's tails. A female penguin usually give birth to only one pango pup. That's all one word, or baby penguin at a time. When it is newborn, a pango pup stays in a burrow with its protective mom curled around it. When it's older, a pango pup like this one here will ride around on its mother's tail until it can look for food on its own. And it commands him to, "Hold on, little guy, hold on." Let's see. The Chinese penguin lost its parents to trafficking, the picture here. But the orphan was rescued and is now getting bottle fed. Even though there are laws to protect penguins, people still illegally capture and kill them. People also destroy penguin habitat to build farms and cities. But some people are trying to help by protecting penguin habitat, stopping traffickers, and rescuing orphaned and wounded penguins. So now that you know how special they are, you can help spread the word. Protect penguins now. Where penguins live. Yeah, see, that's in Africa and Asia is where they like to hang out. Okay, let's do another article here from Ranger Rick. Mission possible. Pum, 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 pum. This article by Kathy Cranking. All animals have the same mission, to stay alive. The ocean creatures in this story use secret weapons and clever tricks to help them do it. First off, they got here, sting operation. They got a picture of a hermit crab. This hermit crab works undercover to accomplish its mission. Like other hermits, it lives in an old shell to protect its soft body, but that's only part of its scheme. The crab then booby-traps the shell with stinging anemones. When it finds an anemone stuck to a rock or another place, it strokes and taps the anemone until the anemone loses its grip. Then the crab grabs the anemone and places it on its shell. It does this until it's covered with stinging creatures. The frilly anemone bodyguards help disguise the crab from octopuses and other hungry enemies, and any enemy that does attack gets zapped. The next one here says, watch it, using tricks, disappearing act. The flowery flounder accomplishes its mission by being a master of disguise. First of all, it has a flat body that makes it hard to see as it lies on the ocean floor. Even better, this flounder can change its colors to match its surroundings. In just seconds, the fish has hidden itself from enemies by disappearing against the sandy ocean bottom. Then there's inky cover-up. Spies on a mission sometimes write with invisible ink to trick their enemies. The common cuttlefish has a different way of using ink on its mission, and the ink isn't invisible at all. That's the point. When a cuttlefish feels threatened, it releases a cloud of dark, inky stuff. The ink makes a big blob in the water. It can startle or confuse an enemy while hiding the cuttlefish from view. That gives the cuttlefish time to make a great escape. And what is this? Choking hazard. A slow-swimming puffer fish can't make a quick getaway from a predator, but there's no need for speed when you can outsmart your enemies. If a shark or other hungry creature threatens, the puffer starts gulping water. As it gulps, its skin stretches. The puffer keeps gulping until it has ballooned to 3 or 4 times its normal size. A puffed-up puffer might be too hard to swallow, and the enemy's meal plan will be foiled. Let's see the next one they got. Packing poison. Let's see if I can pronounce this. Nudibranch. Nudibranch. This nudibranch protects itself with what it eats. It feeds on jellyfish relatives that have stinging cells. The stingers don't bother the nudibranch, though they travel through its body and end up inside those finger-like parts on its back. An enemy that attacks a nudibranch will get stung by the stolen stingers. Well-armed is the next one. Of course, sometimes the mission fails and an enemy's attack is successful. There it is. But for this necklace sea star, that may not be the end of the story. Even though a hungry predator bit off 4 of the sea star's arms, the star has a trick to survive. It can grow new arms. You can see the smaller arms that are growing back. And it says, well done, sea star. What is this here? Next up, using weapons. Painful finjection. Enemies should steer clear of this lionfish. Those frilly fins are hiding the fish's secret weapons, long, sharp spines. An enemy that attacks may regret it. The spines inject venom, causing a very painful sting. Next one up, spilling its guts. The soft, squishy leopard sea cucumber is a relative of sea stars and sea urchins. This slow-moving creature may seem mild-mannered, but in the face of danger, it has an extreme way of protecting itself. It shoots its insides out of its rear end. Those sticky, icky strings can distract or even entangle an enemy while the sea cucumber crawls safely away. Later, its insides will grow back. This is getting creepier and creepier. Next one here. Put 'em up. Has this pom-pom crab disguised itself as a cheerleader to fool enemies? Nope, that's not what's going on at all. Those pom-poms are really sea anemones with stingers, like the other one. The crab holds them as weapons, waving them to scare away any creatures that threaten it. And they got one more secret code. Normally, the blue-ringed octopus keeps a low profile. Its dull-colored body usually blends in with the tide pools and coral reefs it creeps around in. But if an enemy threatens, everything changes. The octopus's skin breaks out in blue flashing circles. The bright pattern is like a coded message for predators. Stay away. I'm dangerous. Enemies that don't crack the code and attack anyway could be sorry. The octopus is one of the most venomous animals in the ocean. Okay, let's go back to Science News Explorers. Got a good article in here. Teen chemist uncovers potentially harmful preservatives in pet food. Inspired by her dog's health problems, Mackenzie Wilson measured a worrying chemical in dog food brands. Maria Temming wrote this particular article. Mackenzie Wilson, 14 years old, never planned on doing a science fair project, but when one of her dogs kept getting rashes that seemed to be linked to what pet food she'd been eating, Mackenzie got curious. She wanted to know what chemicals people were feeding their furry friends. In her research, Mackenzie read some past studies that suggested a preservative called BHT might be toxic. So Mackenzie homed in on this chemical. She ground up 3 brands of dry dog food used by many of her friends and family. Then she soaked the powder in alcohol to release any BHT. A couple of techniques helped her analyze how much BHT had been in the food. One was spectrometry. The other, high-performance liquid chromatography. Akana Wilderness and Wellness brands all contained about 0.1% BHT, but none listed it on their nutrition labels. No. An aspiring veterinarian, Mackenzie did her project as an eighth grader at Eastern Middle School in Riverside, Connecticut. Her research earned her a finalist spot in the 2024 Thermo Fisher Scientific Junior Innovators Challenge. She also won the second place science award at the competition. This program is run by the Society for Science, which also publishes Science News Explorers, which is what I'm reading right now. Let's see here. Mackenzie reflects on her science fair project. They ask her, what was your favorite part of this project? And she says, well, definitely using all the machines. To do her research, she enrolled in a program where students in her district visited a high school lab early in the morning each week. It was really cool, using all the instruments and learning how they worked, she says. The other very fun part was explaining the research to people that I got the dog food brands from. What was it like going to your first science fair? It was very nerve-wracking, Mackenzie says. I had never done anything like that before. In all, she found the fair experience fun and rewarding. I made a bunch of friends, she says, meeting so many new people with different ideas. You can really learn more about science just from being in a science fair, not even winning anything, but just going there and experiencing it. What was the most challenging part of the project? The challenging part was having to come in on weekends and having to wake up so early, Mackenzie says. She had to balance her science fair project with schoolwork and extracurricular activities. I had nationals for field hockey during one of the weekends, so I had to go in right before leaving for Pennsylvania to practice my whole science presentation. Any advice for juggling science fair with other activities? Organization is key. I use a Google Calendar, Mackenzie says. It can really help you be able to juggle and manage everything. And if someone is unsure about whether to try a science project at all, give it a shot, she adds. It may end up being very good for you, and if not, then you'll learn. You can always attempt it next year. Okay, sticking with... what am I doing? Science News Explorers. This article entitled Scientists Say Sundog. Sundog. This word describes a rainbow-like halo around the sun, says Allison Pierce Stevens, who wrote this particular article. Sundogs are bright flares of light that can appear on either side of the sun in the sky. They form when incoming sunlight bends or refracts off tiny prism-shaped ice crystals in the atmosphere. Because of the angles inside these six-sided ice crystals, sundogs appear 22 degrees away from the sun in the sky. Sundogs can appear alone as a pair on either side of the sun or on a halo that circles the sun. They can also occur at night when the moon is bright. These are known as moondogs. I did not know that. Sundogs often contain a colorful, rainbow-like streak. That's because the sun's white light is made up of many different wavelengths or colors of light, and those light waves bend at slightly different angles off ice crystals in the air. This separates incoming sunlight into the colors of the rainbow, but unlike a rainbow, which always has red on the outer edge, red appears on the inside of the sundog closest to the sun. Blue appears on the outer edge of the sundog furthest from the sun. Sundogs appear only when the sun is fairly low in the sky. When the sun climbs too high, the sunlight doesn't hit the ice crystals at the right angles, and light can't refract in a way that we can see, so sundogs disappear. Sundogs are most common at cold temperatures, but they can occur when it isn't freezing out. They can appear anywhere on Earth as long as there are ice crystals in the atmosphere. This often happens with wispy, high-flying cirrostratus clouds. The appearance of those clouds can indicate that rain is on the way. Okay, let us go over to Time, a magazine for kids. It's time for kids. Life in Lava Tubes is the name of this article. I don't know why that's funny to me. Maya Wehas wrote this article. It goes a little bit like this. Standing in one of Hawaii's caves, you might think it's empty. It's dark and it's quiet. Not many plants or animals call this place home, but there's a lot of life. Oh, yes, most of it you just might not notice. Let's see, there might be patches of gold, silver, tan, or pink on the cave walls. Shine a light on them, and the water droplets make the patches appear to shimmer. These shining splotches of color consists of microbes. Yikes. Scientists have been studying these microbes. One reason is that some might be similar to life that once lived on Mars, and maybe still does. Under the surface, many of Hawaii's caves are lava tubes. They were formed by volcanic activity. After an eruption, hot lava can flow like a river. Over time, air cools the surface, hardening it into black basalt. But underneath, molten lava may still flow. As it drains away from the basalt, it leaves behind an empty tube or cave. You get pictures of it here. It's really cool looking, like a river. Hot lava flows after an eruption. It cools. Okay, they already talked about that. Article continues, lava tubes exist on Mars, too. So scientists wonder, do rock-loving microbes also exist there? By studying Hawaiian caves, researchers hope to unlock, there it is, what life might be like on other worlds. Who is this? Rebecca Prescott, an astrobiologist at the University of Mississippi, told Time for Kids, "It's a good place to start." She's part of a team of scientists who have been looking at microbes in Hawaiian caves. They found some species that hadn't been seen before. Microbial cities. Cave microbes have their own ways of surviving their environment. Some get energy from eating the rocks. Many of these species are ancient, allowing scientists to understand how microbes lived billions of years ago. "When you walk into a lava cave," Prescott says, "it's like you're walking back in time." Scientists are now learning how groups of microbes communicate. Microbes grow in communities that form a slimy film on cave walls. The organisms within a community can talk to one another by sending out chemical signals. They may help them tackle tasks together, such as building these slimy cities. Microbes might be important team members on future Mars missions. A one-way trip to the Red Planet could take 8 months. Astronauts might need to grow their own food, but not many plants can grow in the planet's rocky red dirt, and microbes might help. Here on Earth, some microbes break down toxic chemicals in dirt. Others can eat rocks, releasing nutrients to make soil more friendly to plants. Scientists think that microbes can do the same thing on Mars, helping turn a rocky dirt into rich soils for future Martian gardens to grow. Not Marvin Gardens, Martian Gardens. With that bad joke, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.